Lircay, Angaraes Province, Department of Huancavelica, Central Peru. The wind whistles sharply as it gusts along the narrow, solitary path winding down from the mountaintop. The shifting leaves on the trees hiss. Their sound ominous in the deep dark, urging the lone traveler to pick up speed. Tightening his grip on the blanket, strapping his belongings to his back, he ducks his head down, seeking warmth in his worn brown poncho, grateful for the thick alpaca sweater beneath it as well. The sibilant trees fall silent as the gust dies down. In the sudden quiet, the clatter of sliding rocks and dirt startles the man. Sure of his own footing on the dirt path, aware that his own footsteps did not slip, he darts a look behind him and sees a shaking bush, startling until the other nearby bushes join as another gust of wind barrels down the mountainside. He shakes himself, shifts his bundle on his back, and continues his downward trek, muttering to himself softly. He knows the dangers of walking alone at night in the Sierra. The things that can find you if your luck runs out. The disappeared who never come back. Even the old man who swore he evaded death in a black poncho and hat. A figure with a glittering, curved knife, made for separating a man's head from his body. Picking up his pace, he shoots glances up the curving path behind him, alert for anyone, anything that might be following him. Nothing. He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a couple of coca leaves from the pouch inside, popping them in his mouth to help keep him alert and awake as he steps into the next curve in the trail, only to be stopped by large, brutal hands and swung to the ground without any effort, as if he were a child. The traveler lies there, winded and terrified. A tall man stands above him, clothed in black, his face covered by a scarf that matches his poncho and hat. In one hand, he holds a knife. But the stories aren't true. It's not shining. It's covered in blood. From the body he can now see on the ground, among the bushes, off the footpath. The headless body. The victim whose fate he will now share. It's him. The Pishtaco, the Ñacac. His eyes open wide as the blade descends.
Hey.
Have you ever wandered a trail alone, wondering if there was anyone or anything else on it with you? Or ever been told not to venture out alone at night in the countryside, lest some unspeakable harm become you? Have you ever heard of the countless unsolved disappearances in the Peruvian mountainsides? Or perhaps you've wondered about the dark realities that feed legends? If so, bienvenidos and welcome to another episode of Weird Latinx Podcast. My name is Allie Miles, and I want to take you on a strange journey through the things that go bump in the noche. True crime, urban legends, supernatural phenomena, the paranormal, and other weirdness from Latin America and the Latinx diaspora. Don't worry if you don't know Spanish or Portuguese. I'm here to dive into the research and curate the scariest and strangest tales you have probably never heard. But don't think that just because you haven't heard them before,
they won't haunt you.
Our next story comes from Peru in South America. Disfruten. The Andean Stalker, El Pishtaco Ñacac. Enjoy. The Pishtaco, or Ñacac, is a killer who roams the countryside, seeking his victims on lonely roads or mountain passes, always in isolated places. Stalking travelers, the Pishtaco surprises his human prey, often beheading the poor soul and then cutting his victim into pieces. Having no use for the arms, legs, or head, he severs them and dumps them into rivers or ravines. Then wraps the torsos and carries them for processing, the most profitable parts. He hangs the butchered torsos from meat hooks over an array of candles and a large pot, collecting the melting human fat as it drips down into the container. In some cases, this killer uses human body parts as food, going so far as to make chicharrón, or cracklins, deep fried skin. It is believed that if not ingested, this collected human fat is used to make medicine or even to lubricate foreign machinery. Despite this cannibalism and brutal profiteering from bodies, the Pishtaco is undoubtedly human, using brute strength, magic, or other arcane knowledge to feast on his fellow man. Where did this killer come from? How long has this predator attacked people in the Sierra? Turns out, it was a long time ago. The idea of the pishtaku, or nyakak, has been around since 1400 BC, when the Pucará culture lived in the northwest area of Lake Titicaca, in what is now the southern Peruvian province of Puno. There are stone monoliths and other crafted figures that show a creature, a half-man with a feline face, holding a human head. The largest of these, named Hatun Nyakak, or the Great Beheader, stands almost 3 feet high, with a knife in one hand, the human-sized head in the other. Another, named El Devorador, or the Devourer, is a human figure devouring what appears to be a child. These can both be seen in the Museo Lítico de Pucará, the lithic or stone archaeological museum of Pucará, and virtually through TV Peru's program, Museos Puertas Abiertas. The Pucará were in turn part ancestors and influencers of the Tiwanaku culture, who expanded from south of Lake Titicaca to areas including modern-day Peru, Bolivia, and even Chile. They flourished from 1500 BC to almost 1200 AD. The Tiwanakus were around a long time. The Tiwanakus also have similar artifacts depicting beheaders, with one known now as El Sacrificador Rojo, or the Red Sacrificer, found at the base of Tiwanaku's Acapana Pyramid, where excavations showed a number of sacrificial bodies as well. El Sacrificador Rojo is a red-tinged figurine, stained not by blood, but by cinnabar, holding a person over his knees, one hand pulling him by the hair to expose his neck, the other holding a blade against his throat. Severed human heads hang from the sacrificer's belt, and one head dangles from the back of his headdress by its trachea or spinal column. These figures clearly depict a creature who decapitates others and uses their body parts. In other words, an ancient pishtaku. At the time that Tiwanaku was the largest civilization in the south of present-day Peru, the Wari culture controlled an equivalent area north of the Tiwanaku. The Wari, in turn, were deeply influenced by their predecessors, the Moche. The Moche culture celebrated its deity, Ay Apec, the decapitator, and featured murals depicting decapitations in their huacas, or sacred sites. Another representation of the sacrificer in ancient Moche iconography shows human sacrifices utilizing the tumi, a ceremonial knife with a human figure on the hilt. Moche drawings show a clear difference between two types of killings in the pre-Hispanic world. There was a difference between human sacrifice and the punishment of rebels. Ritual beheading as a sacrifice had a message for the spirit world, but the deaths of others who had infringed upon social order was a slow and cruel death that included removing the skin, disemboweling, and butchering the victim. Again, these cultures clearly had beings that displayed the characteristics of what was later termed Nyakak. As these empires collapsed or waned, They fragmented into subcultures and were absorbed by the Incas, who adopted and in some cases even transported Ñacac figures, like the monoliths, throughout their empire. The Incas remained the largest civilization along the Andes until the arrival of the Spanish conquistadores. Once Pizarro and his ilk invaded, their behavior during the invasion became inexorably linked with that of the beings that decapitated indigenous people. The clearest example of what the Pixtaco developed into occurred when the Spanish under Francisco Pizarro conquered the Incas in 1533. They brought with them priests to evangelize and convert the indigenous people of the Andes. It was said that in one hand they carried the Bible and in the other a whip. They sought conversion by any means. Bernal Díaz del Castillo, a contemporary of Pizarro's and companion of Hernán Cortés in Mexico, described the Spaniards' use of human fat in 1519 in his book, Verdadera Historia de los Sucesos de la Conquista de la Nueva España, True History of the Occurrences of the Conquest of New Spain, like this.
Y esto pasando, apretamos las heridas a los heridos compañeros, que otra cosa no había, y se curaron los caballos con quemalles las heridas con unto de indio de los muertos que había por el campo.
And with this happening, we covered the wounds of the injured with cloths, because there was nothing else. And we cured the horses by burning their wounds with the lard of dead Indians that lay in the fields. The indigenous people fighting against the Spanish saw with their own eyes the pillaging of their people's bodies, used with utter callousness by the invaders.
Y con el unto del indio que ya he dicho otras veces, se curaron nuestros soldados, que fueron 15, y murió uno de las heridas, y también se curaron 4 o 5 caballos que estaban heridos.
And with the lard of the Indians that I have discussed before, our soldiers, who numbered 15, were healed, and one died of his wounds, and we also healed 4 or 5 horses that were also injured. At this time in Spain and throughout Europe, many parts of dead bodies were used for all manner of potions and elixirs meant to cure diseases and relieve infirmities. Bones were ground into powders. Blood and other vital fluids were packaged and sold by the very executioner who killed the person he parceled out. Human fat, or auxingia hominis, the medicinal name for it in the 16th and 17th centuries, was frequently touted as a cure for wounds. Although the indigenous Andeans were horrified by the Spanish use of the bodies of their fallen, another author wrote, 100 years later, that Incas used human fat as well. Only this time, it was used in invocations and incantations. The Andean author Felipe Huaman Puma de Ayala, a man of mixed indigenous and Spanish heritage, wrote in 1613 about the use of human fat by Ñacac. He identifies them as sorcerers in his book, El Primer Nueva Crónica y Buen Gobierno, The First New Chronicle and Good Government, where he described life before the arrival of the Spanish and after the Spanish conquest of the Andes, saying,
A estos hechiceros, dicen los cuales tomaban una olla negra,
que llaman arimanca. They call these sorcerers, who take a newly made pot they call arimanca, that they heat without anything inside. And they take the fat of a person and maize and wood and feathers and coca leaves and silver, gold, and every kind of food. They say that they throw them all inside the pot and they burn them a lot. And with that, the sorcerer speaks, because within the pot, demons speak. Either as ingredients stripped from human sacrifices by Nyekak, sorcerer priests, or medical treatments snatched from the bodies of fallen enemies by Spanish soldiers, the butchering and profiting from indigenous bodies serve to terrify and pacify a population. As the Spanish settled more indigenous territory, they enslaved and profited from the bodies of the conquered. Many people were taken from places like Parinacochas, near Ayacucho, and made to work in the mines to provide gold and silver for their overlords. By the middle of the 1560s, a famine gripped the native population as well. The fear and fury against the new Spanish oppressors eventually generated a rebellion decades after first contact. Around 1564, almost three decades after the Inca Empire was defeated, an indigenous resistance movement, Taquioncuy, rose in the Andes against the Spanish invasion. It was a rejection of colonial exploitation, of Spanish rule and religion, repudiating the Catholic Church, its God, and its priests. Jesuits, Franciscans, mercenary Tatacuras, all the representatives of the Catholic Church became instruments of fear and death, not just to their way of life, but to the indigenous people themselves. A Spanish cleric, Cristóbal de Molina, chronicled this in 1575, describing one of the foundational fears of the conquered indigenous people.
España había enviado a este reino por unto de los indios para sanar cierta enfermedad que no se hallaba para ella medicina, sino el dicho unto.
In the year 1571, believed by the Indians that Spain had sent to their kingdom to collect the fat from the Indians to heal a certain illness for which there was no cure other than Indian fat, which then caused the Indians to be wary and stay away from Spaniards to such a degree that they didn't want to take wood, plants, and other things to Spanish houses, because they believed they would be killed inside in order to steal their fat. The Spanish were able to quell the Taquioncuy by 1572, culminating with the execution of Tupac Amaru, the last legitimate successor of the Inca Empire. This cemented the mistrust and fear they generated in the indigenous populace, and the Spaniards' role as outsiders, as well as the distrust of those who worked with them. This foreign otherness was to be a key aspect of the Pixtaco Nyekak. The executioners and sacrificers in pre-Hispanic times were sorcerer priests, intermediaries with a mythical or divine world. Seen in that way, it was only natural that Catholic priests were perceived as the sorcerer priests of the white invaders. They would be the ones extracting fat for their deity. The parallels between Nyekak and Spanish priests were clear to a conquered people, and the two were inexorably tied. The colonial Pixtaco was primarily a white colonizer, attacking indigenous people who were traveling alone. A Spanish monk fit the bill easily. A man who prayed and converted natives by any means during the day was the creature who hunted them down and killed them for their fat at night. In the 17th century, Bethlehemite missionaries, members of the only clerical order both founded and extinguished in America, were killed in Cusco, Peru. They were suspected of killing the native people and burying them beneath the corners of the churches in Cusco. It's important to note that the churches and many other important buildings in Cusco and other Andean towns were built on top of indigenous structures. The remains of temples served as foundations for Spanish imperialism. If you go to Cusco today, you can actually touch the ancient stones that hold up colonial churches and buildings. Tending the sick was also part of the Bethlehemites' devotion, and the fact that many died under their care confirmed their identity as Pixtacos. After all, everyone knew that the bells of Spanish churches were also oiled with human fat. That was what made them sound sweeter, truer, in their call to believers. Human fat was also used to anoint the faces of carved saints in those same churches the priests ran. Many stories collected at the time confirm the fear of Bethlehemites. The disappearance of many people from the area of Ichu, which is now Puno in southern Peru, was blamed on the priests. The farmers were robbed by a Bethlehemite friar who, after cutting off their heads, would extract the fat from their bodies. When this friar was found out, he was lynched and killed, freeing the community of the Ñacac. By 1723, when the indigenous people of Cusco saw a Bethlehemite friar, they shouted, "Ñacac! Ñacac! Decapitator!" They believed that the friars would disembowel them and remove their fat, not only for their bells and statues, but to make medicinal axungia hominis, the medicinal human fat mentioned earlier. This special treat was then sent to the King of Spain, along with the other wealth stolen from native people. The behavior of Catholic priests during the entire Spanish colonization of Peru only served to reinforce this belief. In the 1650s and 60s, priests punished heretics, indigenous people who continued to worship or hold on to traditional beliefs in magic and deities. In towns like Huamantanga, San Gregorio de Andacoto, and San Pedro de Carac, priests charged and presided over trials, torturing the defendants to have them confess or testify against others. Eventually, the accused were sent to prison in Lima, and their assets and belongings were taken by the priests. The summaries of these cases are heartbreaking. The belongings taken range from a small herd of sheep to three old blankets and a patched cloak. The floggings and torture were perpetuated mostly against indigenous women, particularly poor, old widows or unmarried women. An unsurprising power dynamic. The ill and infirm dying under their care. Torture, imprisonment, theft of their possessions, all in the name of the church. everything pointed to these Spanish priests, continuing the deadly practices of the other conquistadores. It was simple enough to see Catholic priests as ñacac. On January 6, 1617, a number of indigenous people, including Alonso Huaman and Martin Chagua, accused Father Luis de Mora y Aguilar, the parish priest of San Francisco del Achaque, of compelling them to pay him and requiring 11 indigenous people, 4 men and 7 women, to serve him without pay or remuneration. This compulsion and forced labor was a common practice among the Spanish ruling class when they took land. When the church became a great landholder in the conquered territories of Peru, the priests became de facto landowners. They also acted like the feared Spanish landholders, or encomenderos, displaying all their vices and terrifying behaviors. Many instances of enforced labor were practiced in Spanish encomiendas, a grant of land and the conquered native people who lived on it, given in perpetuity to a conquistador, priest, church, what have you. Although direct ownership of the land was held by the Spanish crown, the right to collect tribute from the people on the land was absolute. When encomiendas were outlawed in 1533, a new system, repartimiento, was established. Deemed better than the previous system, not quite slavery, because the worker was not owned outright. As Queen Isabella decided in 1501 that indigenous people were people and subjects of the crown. But they owed tribute in forced labor for a specified number of months. This sent millions of native people into gold, silver, and mercury mines, the fields, and more, to work for the encomenderos. Sorry, the not encomenderos. Colonial Peruvian encomenderos refused to change the system, preferring to hold on to it until the 18th century, as it increased generational family wealth and power. To give an example, by 1550, 673 tributaries, those who held encomiendas, held over 1 million Andean people subject to them. And that often meant the power over life and death over their subjects. The following two stories show exactly how much power encomenderos, later turned hacenderos, owners of large farms in the surrounding lands, had over the people in rural communities.
Estos pistacos salían terminado agosto y la grasa que cogían eran para las campanas, para sus cuchillos, para sus
machetes. These pistacos went out at the end of August, and the fat they took was for bells, for their knives, for their machetes, because human fat tempered the metal well. Mr. Fortunato Muñinco told me something that had happened to him with a ñacac. Because these ñacac not only take the fat of human people, but also eat the meat raw or cooked, hot or cold. Don Fortunato lived above us near the Ajomachay Bridge, or Cueva del Perro, the dog's cave. Don Fortunato worked for an hacendado who was evil. He brought people to tears, was a self-proclaimed lawyer and a troublemaker. But Don Fortunato did not know that he was a ñacac. One day, the hacendado told him to come with him to find meat.
"We're going to bring meat," he told him, "because I want to serve the local authorities. And we're going to prepare cracklings for them."
At 6 o'clock in the afternoon, the patron made Don Fortunato ride behind him on the haunches of a large horse. They reached the Aijomachay Bridge, and there, the landowner stopped the horse and fed it alfalfa. Don Fortunato accompanied the hacendado to the hill to scope things out, and they saw two travelers coming. The ñacac put something on the road, at the edge of the mud-filled rushing river. But Don Fortunato did not know what it was. It served to separate the travelers so that only one of them would step out and cross the bridge, and the other would turn back like a fool. All the while, the hacendado was curing his machete with a thick grease he had inside a white bottle. Later, Don Fortunato found out it was the placenta of dark-skinned Yana women from the Sierra near Arequipa. This placenta gave special power to the machete, being better than ordinary human fat, making the machete strike the air and ring. There are auspicious stars for the ñacac as well, and the hacendado peered up at them and said, "We are fine. We are going to have a good hunt." And so it was, because as soon as the traveler stepped onto the bridge, the hacendado suddenly cut off his head and snapped his knees and arms. Don Fortunato could not believe how quickly it happened. He says that heads severed by the ñacac fall so quickly, they bite the stones on the ground. The hacendado began to drink the fresh blood that poured out of the head, and then cut off the tongue. Then he quickly removed all the meat and all the steaming hot pulp from the man's insides. He stuck it all in his saddlebags. This was the chicharrón, the fried skin he gave to the local officials. To the subprefect, who was a fat glutton, to His Holiness the priest, and to the gentleman judge. They were all despicable and cursed because they helped the ñacac take lands away from poor people. Don Fortunato says that the party the ñacac threw was huge, and the guests all asked for seconds, taking human leftovers wrapped in panca, or corn husks. The ñacac served the poor travelers deep-fried skin alongside yellow potatoes with boiled hominy and onion relish prepared with the victim's blood. The hacendado had also obtained good cane pisco, an alcoholic spirit, and wine from his Huanchac vineyards. Don Fortunato also ate the food, because the patron threatened him if he didn't. And he said that it was tasty, but that human meat does not let you sleep, and one has to get used to it. Only after having eaten it 3 or 4 times does your body get used to it, and human meat doesn't bother you anymore, and you're able to sleep well. Everyone is afraid of these ñacac, and even the ladies, out of fear. Women just accept their amorous attentions. When a ñacac is courting, the woman just goes with him, because if not, the ñacac will kill her husband and eat him. The pishtaco is no longer human. He has no community or family. He sees us all as nakana, meat to eat, livestock on 2 feet. This testimony by Jesús Urbano Rojas, a renowned master of the folk art of retablos and author of Santoruraj Nyampurech, Faith Healer and Walker, describes how even the unwilling are pulled into the Pixtacos sphere. Don Fortunato was forced into horrified participation in the slaughter and then eating of another human. And even the local women accede to unwanted sexual overtures to save themselves and their loved ones from the Pixtacos' violence. Sometimes an individual would help an hacendado without knowing his terrible profession.
La siguiente historia le pasó a mi tatarabuela. Esta historia fue contada de padre a hijo.
The following story happened to my great-grandmother. This story was told from father to son until it reached me. In the early 1900s, my grandmother was born with a gift of healing. From a young age, she learned to heal the sick and to know the benefits of herbs until she became a well-known healer. After many years, when she was around 20 years old, some mysterious visitors came to her house. The travelers told her that even though they lived very far away, they had heard of a young woman who had the gift of healing and could cure the sick. They had wandered from town to town, asking after her, until they were told that a healer lived in her family's house. They asked her to please accompany them to their boss's lands, where she would be well paid. Their patron was a very wealthy man, and he would give her everything she asked for, as long as she cured him. My great-great-grandmother told them to bring their patron so that she could cure him. But the travelers said,
"It's impossible, because he is very seriously ill and cannot leave the house."
They then begged her to accompany them and promised to pay all expenses. At first, my great-great-grandmother's family refused. They said no, because the visitors were strangers, and no one knew if they were lying.
No.
The men insisted she accompany them and assured her family that nothing bad would happen to her. My great-great-grandmother's mother insisted she not go, saying that she would not let her daughter go to a remote place with strangers. The travelers, seeing that they could not change her mind, took out a bag with several gold coins. At the same time, they stated they would leave the coins, accompanied by several animals, as collateral. The family was astounded by the tremendous amount of money and animals. And if this were not enough, a few of the visitors would stay with the family until their daughter returned. In the end, her family agreed. They would allow her to go with them. She was told to prepare because they would leave immediately and the trip would take approximately 3 days. After 2 days of traveling, my great-great-grandmother realized the travelers were taking her to a very isolated place. Everything was desolate. She couldn't see anyone around them, and as they continued, the land around them grew still. She began to worry that they had tricked her and were going to harm her. On the last day of travel to the supposed hacienda, my great-great-grandmother was on guard, because she thought that everything was a lie, and at any moment the travelers would act in bad faith. But my great-great-grandmother's scare did not last long, because at a distance she saw an enormous house and many servants nearby. When she arrived at the main house, the servants told her that she should feel at home, and that the patron would attend to her shortly. She settled into her room, and several minutes later, she was called to see him. When the patron saw my great-great-grandmother, he told her, "In this place, feel safe. No one will harm you. You are under my protection. You can go anywhere you want, but do not dare to enter the house at the back of the hacienda. It is forbidden for you." A few days later, after working to cure the patron, my great-great-grandmother saw that he was slowly getting better. In a few more days, he would be completely healed. She had familiarized herself with the entire hacienda, except the house that the boss had forbidden. Knowing that the patron would be cured in a few days, she didn't want to leave the hacienda without investigating what was inside the forbidden house. Her curiosity was so great that she planned to enter the forbidden structure one afternoon, while everyone was eating. Just as she planned, when everyone sat down to eat, she secretly entered the furthest house on the hacienda. As she entered the forbidden structure, in the distance, she saw what seemed to be several animals hanging over the floor. Under each one, a bowl collected something, dripping out of the body of each animal. She didn't notice anything wrong until she entered further. As she approached the hanging animals, she looked more carefully and realized that they were in fact not animals. They were hanging human bodies. Shocked, she screamed. Nearby servants were alerted by the scream and rushed to enter the structure to find her motionless and screaming in fear. My great-great-grandmother believed that by not obeying the patron's orders, she would share the same fate as the hanging bodies. The servants asked her to calm down and said they would escort her back to her room. When she got there, she was in tears, believing that she would join the bodies in the forbidden house. After a few minutes, the patron sent for her to join him in the living room. The patron looked at her and said, "I'm a pishtaco. All my life, I have been a pishtaco. This tradition passed from father to son and so on among all the descendants of my family. I have made all the fortune you see around you by being a pishtaco. In appreciation for the fact that you've cured me, I will not harm you after you disobeyed me. I feel well enough now, so tomorrow morning you will return home. Do not tell anyone what you saw here or else we will come for you. The next day, when my great-great-grandmother left the Pixtacos Hacienda, as payment for curing him, the patron gave her a large amount of money that lasted her several years. Many decades later, when my great-great-grandmother was very, very old, she did not want to take her knowledge to the grave, so she began to narrate her experiences to the entire family. And this is how I come to tell it to you. It's no surprise that the landholding gentry could also be Pixtacos. Originally Spanish nobles and Creoles, children of Spanish parents born in colonial lands, were the elite of colonial Peru. Over time, successful mestizos, or mixed blood, half Spanish, half indigenous people, joined their ranks, running encomiendas. Their power base included commerce, mining investments, and ownership and exploitation of farms. They controlled government, profitable occupations, and collected tributes, often in the form of unpaid labor from indigenous peons. These feudal encomiendas remained, changing names into haciendas when former encomenderos were able to consolidate their actual ownership of the land they held in trust for the crown during colonial times. By the early 1800s, these large landed estates often specialized in agriculture and made a large profit for individuals and families. Curacas, from the Quechua curac, meaning eldest or first son, were provincial magistrates, or lower nobility, established during the time of the Inca Empire. A part of the provincial bureaucracy of the Inca Empire, curacacuna, the plural form, were in charge of collecting the mita, or tax, provided by each head of household to the Inca. Mita was a system of obligatory work that was used for public works, like building roads or temples, or it also could be mineral extraction or agricultural work. Both of these systems were very useful to the invading conquistadores, who blended those concepts and baked them right into their encomiendas. During Spanish colonial times, curacas became the intermediaries between Spanish encomenderos and the subordinate native people. They directed and collected tributes owed to the encomienda. This often put them at odds with their communities, and when the curacas chose to side against the Spanish crown, like Tupac Amaru II, who led a rebellion in 1781, the fallout against them and their people was bloody and final. But when curacas embraced the Spanish crown, they became a hierarchy that even married into Spanish families, from which many wealthy mestizos emerged. Mestizos that in turn owned land, businesses, and mines. This also meant that over time, the idea of the white colonizer Pixtaco grew to include them and wealthy indigenous leaders. Beheading and profiting from human fat was not just for the landowning class or priests. As Peru became an independent republic in 1824, a Pixtaco could be a neighbor or any stranger met on the road. Thank you. A long time ago, around the beginning of the Peruvian Republic, there were men in the outskirts of rural towns who killed people who wandered out into the countryside. Especially those who were fat and had a good voice. For it was said that the blood and fat of these people was used in the forging of bells. And they say, the better the voice, the better the sound of the pealing bells. These bloodthirsty men, known as pishtacos, were feared by all the townspeople. The town of San Buenaventura has a story that proves the existence of these pishtacos. At this time, there were close ties between the citizens in the community. They were like a single, large family for all their work. So when one individual made their house, everyone helped. One day, one of them wanted to make their house, and as was customary, all the women and men went to help. Only the roof, which was made out of hay, remained undone, and they all decided to look for hay in the heights of the sierra. They all set out together, and since it was far away, they stopped to rest and eat their cold provisions. They had cancha, which is toasted corn, and cheese, jerky, potatoes, and toasted beans. As they were eating, they were surprised by a group of strangers who showed up and offered them some of their food under the guise of friendship. The strangers offered chicharrones, or toasted pieces of pork crackling. But the women in this party were not deceived by the strangers. The women knew they were pishtacos. They tried signaling to their husbands, gesturing not to touch the meat because they believed that they had narcotics in them. The men did not listen to their wives and kept on eating. Once they finished eating, the strangers left, probably going into hiding, to await the result of their treachery. A few minutes later, almost all the men fell into a deep sleep. Desperate to wake them, the women were unable to do so. As best they could, they struggled to carry them, attempting to hide them in caves or cover them with hay so that the pishtacos could not find them. As soon as the last man was hidden, the women immediately ran towards the village to let the authorities and the rest of the villagers know what had happened. The entire town showed up armed with axes, knives, and machetes to the place where all the men had been hidden. But they were too late. Two were missing. Grief-stricken and angered by the disappearance of their friends, they went looking for the pishtacos who had committed the crime. Around 2 or 3 kilometers away, they finally arrived at a cave where they discovered at first glance the corpses of the missing men. They were headless and hanging by their feet from hooks secured to the rocks that formed the cave. Below them was a giant pan where the blood of the bodies would drip and pool. Horrified and indignant, they hunted for the bandits. One of them was found a few meters from the cave, a pishtaco who was asleep after his disgusting work. One of the townspeople approached him cautiously with an axe in his hand. He struck such a blow on the Pishtako's neck that the murderer's head rolled away. The body without a head stood up immediately with a lurch and then fell down dead. The other Pishtakos heard the commotion and fled without being seen. The family members then carefully picked up the bodies of their loved ones and took them to the town to bury them. They left the body of the Pishtako where it fell so that the crows would feast on it. A killer who looked like anyone. No longer a foreigner or a patron. The Pishtako was no longer easily recognizable by the color of his skin or by his social status. That did not mean that non-Indigenous people were not seen with fear or mistrust, for a large number of stories of Pishtakos with friars and foreigners still abound. But it did mean that this bloody butcher of men would become further entrenched in Peruvian lore. Folklorist and historian Efraín Morote Best investigated the Pishtako Ñacac and made the first comparative study of tales of the Andean stalker in 1952. At that time, he encountered more than 129 oral versions throughout regions of Peru. Countless more have been recounted since as the Pishtako Ñacac made their way from ancient indigenous cultures into the context of the new Republic of Peru, and finally, into the collective memory of a nation. Tales of the Pishtako did not stop as the nation modernized and grew. 19th and 20th century Pishtakos made their way throughout the country and were even splashed on the pages of newspapers and on TV. And even in the 21st century, the Pishtako has emerged and galvanized terrified people into action. But that is a story for next time. Tune in for part 2 of our deep dive into the heart of the Andean stalker, the Pishtako Ñacac. Thank you again for spending your time with us at A Weird Latinx Podcast. We hope you liked our investigation into the stories of the Andean stalker, El Pishtako Ñacac, and their dark history. We pride ourselves in giving you not just the strange, but the story behind it. Historia and horror. We like it like that. Thank you again for keeping up with Weird Latinx as we continue to go through some growing pains and strive to bring you the most complete research and stories possible. If you would like to help us grow, please visit our Patreon. We can be found as Weird Latinx. Many thanks to Edgar Diaz for the fabulous readings of Spanish colonial primary sources. Thank you also to Rimay Cunamanta, Hamutaspa, Pishtako Ñacac, Testimonio de Jesús Urbano Rojas, by Casa de la Literatura Peruana for the reading of Jesús Urbano Rojas's primary testimony,
pistaco, ñacac. And Curando un Pistaco by Peruvianer P.E. You can find both on YouTube. Links to the resources in English and Spanish can be found in the episode notes on our website. And don't forget, if you or someone you know has experienced an unexplainable event that you'd like us to share on Weird Latinx Podcast, or know any tales you would like us to cover, please send us an email at weirdlatinx@gmail.com or drop us a comment at weirdlatinx.com. This again is Allie Miles wishing you good night and spooky sueños.